From Texas to Massachusetts, South Carolina to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Trump administration has successfully completed renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Veronique Darugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with details. The midterm elections now less than a month away. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on how the fight is shaping up for control of Congress. Justices on the Supreme Court of the United States serve lifetime terms, but should there be a term limit? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores. And the confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh has debased the U.S. Senate. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Candidate Donald Trump made renegotiating free trade agreements a core component of his campaign. Now, President Donald Trump has delivered a new free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. Here to take a look at details of the new NAFTA is Veronique Darugi. Veronique is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, now that the Trump administration has arrived at an agreement with both Mexico and Canada on what is essentially a new North American Free Trade Agreement, tell us a little bit about what you see as the strengths and weaknesses of the new agreement.
The biggest strength is that we have a deal. I mean, there was so much chaos and uncertainty surrounding NAFTA that having a deal is a really good thing. It's also a good thing that the deal is honestly just cosmetic for the most part. It's not as bad as it could have been. It doesn't make as much changes as it could have been. The positive changes that are made, honestly, they were already included, most of them, in the TPP deal. And the one pro-liberalization feature is that Canada agreed slightly to open slightly its dairy market by 0.3%. It's not very much, but it's a change. I mean, it is important to note that that most exports from the U.S. to Canada and Mexico were already facing zero tariffs, right? And there was this exception with dairy in Canada. On the bad side, though, is like the auto segment of the deal is pretty bad. It basically increases the cost of producing cars, in particular because they now have to source more from Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. 40% of the car have to be made with workers who are paid 16% an hour. So these are all provisions that increases the cost of doing business for an automaker. And this is all for the purpose of paying no duty between when you export cars between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico.
President Trump, of course, Veronique, had placed a number of tariffs on various Canadian goods. Did the imposition of those tariffs have the desired impact of bringing the Canadians to the table and make concessions? Did that actually play a strong role?
It didn't, because TPP already got these concessions from the Canadian on dairy. Remember, for the most part, there were no tariffs between Canada and the U.S. And this deal keeps a lot of the protectionism that was still in NAFTA. And so it just, you know, the president created this chaos by withdrawing from TPP, which had a lot of these features, then imposing metal tariffs, then threatening with auto tariffs, then getting concessions that we would have gotten in TPP, and by the way, the metal tariffs are still up. So we're still worse off than before it all started.
You've referenced TPP a couple of times in your answers, Veronique. For our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, what is TPP?
TPP was a multilateral trade agreement between a bunch of nations, not Europe, and also a lot of Asian countries. And the purpose was to create more free trade. And then the purpose of multilateral trade agreement is like basically everyone gives a little. And the Canadian had agreed to reduce their dairy tariff. They may have actually kind of give up a little bit more than in TPP, but also the second biggest goal of all of this was to actually put China back against the wall by creating this very attractive free trade zone between other Asian countries and Pacific countries and the U.S. and Canada and also to exclude China. And the only way China could have actually joined was to agree to concession on IP protection and on state-owned enterprises, a lot of the things that we claim we want to see from China. The president withdrew from TPP and then threatened to withdraw from NAFTA. And so here we are today.
So we have this new NAFTA, a new trade agreement, and there was a perception, at least, that the old NAFTA was unfair to the United States. Of course, the president made this a big part of his campaign in 2016. So bottom line here, Veronique, is this an improvement on the old NAFTA?
There are small improvements, for sure. I mean, this was a deal that was over 20 years old. So it happened before the rise of e-commerce and things like this. It needed modernization. Some of the deal does this, and that's a good thing. I mean, there are some, as I said, the slight opening of the dairy market for Canada is a good thing. Also, what it does is that it increases the threshold for selling stuff through the internet for individuals for it to be duty-free. It used to be very, very low, and so that's a good thing. But the balance, like the negative side, is probably worse than the good things we're getting. But again, our baseline was not the old NAFTA pre-President Trump. Our new baseline that we have to look at now realistically is we were in a world where there was the potential of a full withdrawal from NAFTA. There was a potential of the difficulty to find a resolution. There was extreme chaos and uncertainty, and that uncertainty has been lifted. So, yeah, we can lament the fact that this deal is making things a little worse, but at the end, the reality wasn't negotiable. This administration was going to rock the boat for better or worse, and now we can hope for at least a more peaceful environment.
Well, at the very least, another item is checked off of the to-do list. We have been talking with Veronique Therughi, who is a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center, that at George Mason University. And Veronique, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center, also where folks can go to read your writings on this and other subjects.
The Mercatus Center is a free market research center based in George Mason University, and we're nonpartisan, and we do economic stuff. Like, we started with regulation a long time ago, and we are at Mercatus.org. You can read all of my stuff there, but I have a creators column. I'm syndicated with creators. I blog at The Corner, and I also write a column for Reason Magazine, and sometimes I write for the New York Times.
Veronique Therughi of the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thanks as always for being here.
Thank you for having me.
At the offices of the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., Andy Roth is keeping an eye on U.S. Senate races and key congressional races all across the country. And we're going to take an update 1 month before election as to where things stand. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's talk first about the U.S. Senate. It's been an interesting couple of weeks for the Senate. Republicans have a little bit of an advantage by virtue of the map. You might want to just give us a bit of an overview on that, and then we can talk about how things are going in the individual states.
You're right. Republicans do have an advantage right off the bat. They're only defending 8 seats. Or 9 seats, rather, and the Democrats are defending 26. So just right off the bat, they're in good shape. Plus, at least 10 Democrat seats that are up for re-election, Trump won. And some of them Trump won big time, like West Virginia and North Dakota. So the Republicans are definitely in the driver's seat. Now, there's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of spending involved, and there's a lot of good candidates that were recruited involved. So it is making this situation a little bit more difficult for Republicans. They have a 51-49 advantage in the Senate, which is very slim. The best guess right now is that perhaps they'll pick up 1 or 2 seats, but I could easily see them picking up more than that, or having the election be a complete wash where nobody wins or loses net seats. And I can even see Democrats picking up a net 1 or 2 seats. So it's getting hairy.
So a month out, nothing is settled, and the situation is going to remain volatile right up until Election Day. Let's talk, first of all, Andy, in terms of all these Democratic seats that are up, which states are finding that their incumbent Democratic U.S. senators are the most vulnerable and perhaps subject to losing to a Republican challenger?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, you have to look at North Dakota. Heidi Heitkamp is the Democrat there. She's trying to portray herself as a moderate, but it's just not working. And as I mentioned before, Trump won there by double digits. I don't even know what the number is, but it's large. It's north of 20 points, maybe even 30. It's quickly becoming non-competitive now. With 30 days, things could change, but that's looking tougher and tougher for Democrats to pick up. There's the prediction markets where you can bet on who's going to win that race, and those numbers are very insightful, just as much as poll numbers are. And right now, the prediction markets are giving Heidi Heitkamp only a 26% chance of winning that district. So I think she's done, barring any major changes. After that, I think you could see Claire McCaskill in Missouri losing. I think you could see Joe Donnelly in Indiana losing, and maybe a couple of others. So right off the bat, you're down about three seats if you're lucky. But then Republicans have to defend a few seats themselves, namely Arizona, where Jeff Flake is retiring, Ted Cruz in Texas, who is facing basically the number one celebrity candidate the Democrats have this year, and then Marsha Blackburn and Dean Heller in Tennessee and Nevada, respectively each. If the elections were held today, I think that Ted Cruz would win. The Democrat has a lot of bad news coming out recently about a DUI, about making some derogatory comments about women, and a few other things. So I think Cruz could most likely win. Plus, it's Texas, so I think he's got a built-in advantage. In Tennessee, I think Marsha Blackburn should survive that race. She's the Republican. But in Arizona and Nevada, I think it's very possible that the Republicans could lose. So if they lose those two seats, but they pick up two or three seats with Heitkamp, McCaskill, and maybe Donnelly, and maybe one or two others, then you're looking at what I mentioned before, which is probably about a plus one, plus two pickup for Republicans.
What about Joe Manchin? And also, the race in Florida is getting quite competitive, is it not?
Yeah, with Manchin, right after the GOP primary, Patrick Morrisey was the declared winner there. The polls quickly tightened, but Manchin has proved himself to be very squishy when it comes to defining his ideological moorings. So he's portraying himself as an independent. He says he's not necessarily friends with Trump, but that they talk, and that he doesn't always agree with him, but sometimes he does. He gives all of this politician speak rhetoric that for now has pacified a lot of voters. The prediction market that I mentioned earlier, they have Manchin winning he has a 75% chance of winning, and the polls are kind of reflecting that as well. So I think he's, right now, if the election were held today, I think he'd win. But you do have 30 days left. And let me mention also that Trump is going to be spending a lot of time on the road going to these various states and campaigning for the Republicans. So things are definitely heating up. They're not certainly cooling down.
Let's talk just very briefly about the United States House of Representatives. Obviously, we can't get into all the different races that are going on, but just from the mile-high view of it, Democrats need to pick up, what, about 23, 24 seats? What are the prediction markets saying about that?
You're right. I think it is 23 seats, and it's clearly going in the Democrats' direction. I think that right now the prediction markets show that the Democrats have about a 65-68% chance of controlling the House. The question, though, is by what margin? Because just eyeballing all the different races, it could be that they pick up like 25 or 26 seats. So then you're only talking about a 2 or 3 seat advantage, which is nothing in the House, because you're going to have a lot of Democrats from very conservative districts who might not be inclined to follow Pelosi and the liberal San Francisco agenda that they're espousing. So if they do have a majority with that slim of a margin, they may not be able to get to do anything with their agenda, which would be remarkable. And let me also mention the Kavanaugh thing. The Kavanaugh nomination has sparked some enthusiasm among Republican voters. Now, it's unclear what happens after the confirmation vote. If there's a large enough gap between that and the election, does that enthusiasm dissipate or that anger dissipate to the point where it's no longer effective? But if it sticks, then there's still a chance that Republicans could keep the majority. I think without question that they're going to lose seats in the House. It's just a question of how many. And it's possible that the enthusiasm is so strong among Trump supporters that even though he's not on the ballot, they're going to support him and his agenda that the Republicans retain the House.
We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Since the beginning of the Republic, justices of the Supreme Court have held lifetime appointments to their seats. But given the longer lifespans of today, should there be a limit to their terms? We hear more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Debates over the merits of lifetime appointments for Supreme Court justices are literally as old as the Supreme Court itself. But once again, we have to ask whether Supreme Court justices should get lifetime appointments to the court, or if there's a better way to go about deciding how long they should sit on the bench. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this question, I think a somewhat important constitutional question, about whether justices appointed to the Supreme Court should get to serve as long as they want, either until they die or until they retire, or whether there should be some sort of limitation on it, and what that limitation might mean for the very rancorous and partisan process that we've seen play out during the confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who, of course, is President Donald Trump's pick to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court that was left when Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement earlier this year. Now, by the time you're listening to this, it's very possible that Kavanaugh may have been confirmed by the Senate. It looks like we're going to get a vote within the next few days. But that doesn't mean that this debate over term limits or the lack thereof for Supreme Court justices will go away. Indeed, as I said, it's a debate we've been having for a long time. So long, in fact, that Alexander Hamilton actually tackled this same question in Federalist 79. He contrasted the lack of any limits on Supreme Court justices' tenure with rules that existed then in New York State that forbade anyone over age 60 from serving on the bench. And Hamilton ultimately dismissed worries about judges becoming unable to discharge their duties because of advanced age. He said this is an imaginary fear. But, of course, two centuries later, there's still no limit on how long Supreme Court justices can serve, and that actually makes the Supreme Court an outlier, not just among global democracies, but even within the United States, because almost every state has a mandatory retirement age for judges. Usually it's 70 or 75, somewhere around there. And some states also require sitting judges to face the voters at predetermined intervals for up or down retention elections. So it's not as if there's a full-scale election for judges, but there is some sort of a democratic mechanism there. And many of the arguments in favor of placing limits on judges' age or tenure are pretty much the same today as they were in Hamilton's day. Concerns about the mental fortitude of elderly jurists, for example, or about a Supreme Court that could grow out of touch with the nation whose laws it reviews if all the judges are too old. And unlike in Hamilton's time, it's hardly uncommon for judges to remain on the bench well past age 60. Indeed, the average age of the 8 Supreme Court justices that we have right now is 67 years. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, is 85. She's the oldest and says she wants to remain on the court until she is 90. But the acrimonious fight over Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation has given this debate over lifetime appointments a new angle. Term limits have been proposed as a way to make the current system fairer. That's what David Leinhardt argues in the New York Times. He says that it would also impart other benefits like removing aging judges from the high court and giving the Senate a more predictable schedule for knowing when confirmation hearings are going to happen rather than they just suddenly pop up whenever a judge decides to retire or happens to die. Now, the most well-formed plan for term limits comes from Fix the Court, a nonpartisan group interested in making the Supreme Court more open and accountable. They also favor things like TV coverage of oral arguments and making the judges file financial disclosures every year. Fix the Court favors a fixed 18-year term for judges, allowing every president to nominate a new justice in his or her first and third year of each term. So you'd have 18-year term limits, and if those had been imposed in the past, the current makeup of the court actually wouldn't be very different than how it is today. Right now, there are four justices on the court who were nominated by Democratic presidents, and there are four, soon to be five, who were nominated by Republicans. If you go back in time and you implement Fix the Courts system, the current court would have a 5-4 Republican slant, four judges from the George W. Bush administration, four from the Obama administration, and one already appointed by President Donald Trump in his first year in office. And you would have Trump now preparing to replace one of Bush's judges as soon as next year when that term would expire. Now, this arrangement, Fix the Court says, it would solve key problems with the court that have led to the extreme partisanship and the harmful polarization that we see today. And I think this appeal to civility is one that might find a receptive audience after the rancorous and awful Kavanaugh hearings. But would term limits and the predictability that they provide really save us from the nastiness that we've seen on display the last few weeks? Well, I'm somewhat skeptical. Would the stakes really be that much lower if Kavanaugh were in the running for an 18-year term on the court, with everything else being equal? In other words, if the current conservative-liberal split and the potential fate of the abortion law were hanging in the outcome, the promise that Kavanaugh would merely sit on the bench for 18 years would probably not bring Democrats down from the barricades. And nor would it make Republicans any less likely to push for his confirmation. But even if judicial term limits aren't actually a bulwark against the hyperpartisan environment that's increasingly spilling over into the Supreme Court, the idea might be worth considering for two other reasons. For one, people seem to like it. A recent Morning Consult Politico poll found that 61% of voters favored term limits for Supreme Court justices, including majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents. And for a second reason, it would openly acknowledge something that everyone already knows, that control of the Supreme Court is a reward for electoral success. Now, this goes against what the founders may have intended. They wanted lifetime Supreme Court appointments to buffer the justices from political interests. But it's clear now, if it wasn't already, that both sides, Democrats and Republicans, view Supreme Court appointments as the spoils that come from controlling the presidency and the Senate. So if the high court is going to be politicized anyway, maybe it makes sense to have those seats be democratically accountable and actually reflect the results of elections over the previous two decades, which is what the 18-year term limit system would accomplish. Now, imposing term limits would require a constitutional amendment. That's probably an impossibly heavy lift in the current environment, and there's plenty of other stumbling blocks, too. In all likelihood, nothing is going to change. We'll continue to muddle through with the same somewhat broken process that we're using now. Term limits, or the lack thereof, will not fix the underlying problems plaguing all aspects of the Kavanaugh confirmation process. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The next time a nominee to the Supreme Court is presented to members of the Senate needs to act in a more civil fashion. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court was bound to be ideologically controversial because it would create a generally conservative 5-4 majority for what I would argue is the first time since FDR, if not before. I expected that the primary ideological issue would be abortion, and whether he would tilt the balance of the court away from the constitutionally liberal articulation of a right to privacy that permits most abortions to a constitutionally conservative interpretation that the document simply cannot be stretched to the point of either permitting or prohibiting abortions. I expected some charges of misogyny and ingrained prejudice against women, and I thought that the makeup of the Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, 11 white males, many of whom are rather, shall we say, senior, would be used as a case in point by the other side. But I never thought that the process would descend to the level of embarrassing spectacle that it did. No matter the outcome, the Senate, and by extension our entire Republican form of government, has been sullied by the emotionally charged accusations of sexual misconduct and irresponsible drinking, and the equally emotionally charged defenses of Judge Kavanaugh. The self-righteous posturing and preening on both sides of the aisle and the casual discussion of improprieties has made C-SPAN X-rated. The Senate likes to call itself the world's greatest deliberative body. Well, it certainly was not that over the past couple of weeks. It was more like a locker room or a late-night bar venting session. The Me Too movement has properly awakened many Americans to the plight of victims of sexual misconduct, especially rape and attempted rape. It is completely understandable that victims would repress their memories of such incidents and be fearful of disclosing details. However, that new willingness to give the benefit of doubt to victims cannot extend to the point of ignoring relative facts and testimonies. There are many cases of false accusations, even if they constitute the minority of all accusations of sexual misconduct. For instance, there are too many African-American men convicted and jailed after having been accused of rape or attempted rape of white women, where, in fact, the accusation was ill-founded. One of the most well-known of these is the case of high school football star Brian Banks, who was falsely accused, convicted, and serving time in prison when his accuser finally admitted to fabricating the entire claim. We will probably never know what really happened in that summer of 1982 between Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey, or at Yale a few years later. But we are looking at the judicial record of a lawyer and judge whose conduct has never once, to my knowledge, been subject to question or scandal in the many years that he has practiced law or served on the bench. Yet his adolescent conduct may have been reprehensible and should not be dismissed lightly. But it's not the student Brett Kavanaugh of over a quarter century ago who was nominated. It's the judge Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit Court. The wanton disregard of his judicial record by those who oppose him on ideological grounds but don't have the courage or intellect to challenge him on his record shows the world that we debase our ideals by our bombast. I voted for President Trump and I support his nomination of Judge Kavanaugh, but I cringe when I hear him mock Dr. Ford. I think Judge Kavanaugh has what it takes to be a good justice of our Supreme Court, but I cringe when he allows himself to make snide remarks to a senator who is the daughter of an alcoholic, or when he descends into partisan comments about his accusers. Do you, listeners of American Radio Journal, feel the same way? Do you feel the need for a shower after watching some of our senators? Are you tired of political arguments that have little to do with the subject being discussed and are really all about acquiring or holding on to political power? After the dust settles on Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation vote, join me in writing to your two senators to elevate their advice and consent role to something more reflective of a great democracy and less reflective of spoiled and selfish children in a torrid and sordid meltdown. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WKSP-FM in Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Peach State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.